This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Senate Judicial Committee hearings for Christine Blasey Ford and Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh have galvanised voters on both sides of the aisle, as well as shining a light on the deep divide already present in the polarised politics of 2018. What do the hearings foreshadow about the general election? Dr. Susan McManus is a USF Distinguished Professor Emerita of Political Science. Dr. McManus, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder, first of all, if I could get your take on the hearing on Thursday. What did you make of that?
Combustible, and certainly furthering the deep partisan divide, not only in the U.S. but also in Florida, and possibly spiking turnout among both parties in this year's general election.
Now, do you think it could prompt more of a turnout on one side over the other, or do you see it as a bipartisan thing because of the fact that, it really highlighted the partisan political divides in the country?
It's going to spike turnout in both parties. And whichever party prevails, it will mean the other one will certainly show up, and the one that prevails will show up as well.
Before the hearing, I'm wondering, Susan McManus, what was your sense of how much of a part or how big of an influence the Me Too movement would play as an issue in this election?
It was never a doubt, and it started with the visuals of the hearings themselves. The picture of all white males on the Republican side versus the Democrats, knowing that they had a gender diverse component to the committee members. And the Me Too movement has really driven a lot more women to run for office, and women make up a considerably larger share of the Democratic Party than the Republican Party, including right here in Florida. So the bottom line is that the Me Too movement is having a lot of impact actually on both sides of the aisle, because there are still a majority of women Republicans, too, and they see things very differently, and the motives behind the last-minute springing of that memo, they see that differently than the female Democrats.
What are you hearing then? What do you think is the sort of takeaway for women on the Republican side who may not be so, or maybe a little bit skeptical about the timing of the allegations?
For many of them, it will make them even more committed to turning out to vote. The argument among a lot of Republican women and some Democratic is that it seems like the assumption is that if you're a white male, you're guilty. And keep in mind that there are a lot more married Republican women than married Democratic women, and so you have that kind of marital divide that also translates into somewhat of a party divide.
Clearly, in the aftermath of the hearing last Thursday, you had people weighing in, candidates in certain races, for example, the race for Senate, Senator Bill Nelson weighing in saying he would not vote to confirm Judge Kavanaugh, and then you had some reaction from Governor Rick Scott, who's running to replace Bill Nelson in the Senate. What did you make of that little exchange?
Absolutely, partisan divide. They're both in a tight race. The Senate race is one of the most important ones in the whole country. Florida's U.S. Senate race is key to whether Democrats can take back control of the U.S. Senate, and Republicans would love to take that seat away from Florida Democrats, and Democrats in Florida are holding on for dear life, and it's the most expensive race in the whole country right now, and one of the most important. So it really isn't surprising, in light of the divisiveness of our state from a partisan perspective, that each of the candidates would take their party's position. I think Democrats right now make up around 37% of Florida's registered voters, but Republicans 35. The key, of course, is the 28% who are registered as neither Democrats nor Republicans, and that happens to be the fastest growing group.
I'm wondering, too, on that note, because Florida is often seen as neither red nor blue. It's kind of viewed as a bit of a purple state. We saw that in the last presidential election. It was pretty narrow. Would it be a surprise, then, to see Governor Scott weighing in so quickly after that? Might you expect him to hold off and just kind of test the waters a bit if he's looking for those independent voters?
It looks like right now we're at the stage in the Senate campaign where each candidate, both Senator Nelson and Governor Scott, are trying to solidify their base. And this kind of national issue, which is so partisan in nature, it's absolutely essential if they want to keep their base. They've got to again, sort of toe the party line on that issue. But they have to, of course, pivot to other issues because of that huge percentage of our state that's independent and often the swing vote in our state. But it is still the case that Florida is the purplest of purple states, and even gaining in national significance because it's already projected that we're going to win to gain at least two seats after the next census, which will make us even more powerful in the 2020 election. So Florida, once again, is the epicenter.
If you think about sort of partisan divides and candidates who play to their base, or at least, you know, tack to one side or the other, and the current gubernatorial race, Andrew Gillum versus Ron DeSantis. Andrew Gillum, of course, on the Democratic side, surprised quite a few of the pundits because he really rallied that aspect of the party and seemed to be generating that real sort of grassroots momentum that we haven't seen for some time. Do you see the likes of the Kavanaugh hearing playing into that race at all, and any surprises there and his statements in the aftermath of that hearing?
No surprises whatsoever. Absolutely. Those two candidates are also espousing their party's position on the Kavanaugh confirmation. What is really fascinating about the Gillum race was the fact that he targeted key components of the Democratic base that are normally low turnout voters, especially in an August midterm, meaning specifically younger voters and minority voters, and of course progressives, and calculated from the beginning that the winner could win with a mid-30%, which of course what he did. It's also significant that we have witnessed the changing demographics of this state, which the Gillum campaign really honed in on early, and that is that we have a larger share now of younger voters than we used to because of the generational replacement that's taking place with the boomers sort of, you know, on the high end of the age and the younger demographics that are at least half of our registered voters at the moment.
I guess the flip side of that is that, you know, there's always a question, will those younger voters show up during the general election? Some of those fears might have been put to rest during the primary, but what are you thinking kind of leading up to November?
It looks like with the money coming in from Tom Steyer, the $5 million, and the money that was already expended here to the Gillum campaign and to other groups, Next Gen and so forth, that there has been a tremendously successful registration drive to register younger voters. And it also looks like the Gillum campaign is borrowing a page from the playbook of President Obama's successful campaign, and that is, you know, engage younger voters and pay them and make sure that they sort of tag team with new registrants or other young voters to make sure that they vote and keep tagging them till the very end, till they make sure, like calling them every day and reminding them that they need to vote. They need to vote. Have you voted? We see that same kind of technique being utilized by the Gillum campaign at the moment, and it was a little bit missing in the Hillary Clinton campaign.
I wonder if we could look at a couple of the other races. 7th Congressional District, Stephanie Murphy versus Mike Miller. Stephanie Murphy, the incumbent, a Democrat. She won the seat from John Micah, who is a longtime congressman. She's now been challenged by Mike Miller, former state representative. What do you see when you look at that race? How do you see things shaking out there?
We have 6 congressional races right now in the state that are regarded as flippable. 5 of them Democrats regard as possible pickups for them, meaning turning a red district blue. But this congressional district with Murphy and Miller is seen as by the Republicans as one that they might possibly pick up. But it is a very, very competitive race, and it is the case that the incumbent, Stephanie Murphy, is getting the endorsements of groups that normally would endorse Republicans, meaning business groups. Mm-hmm. She has a history of bipartisanship in Congress. On the other hand, Mike Miller is very successful as a state legislator, but had a very tough primary, drained some resources, is now gaining a bit of steam back and running television ads. It's a tight race, but it's probably the case that if you were looking at it, you might just say that this is a case of where the incumbent holds her job.
Is the seat that Ron DeSantis used to hold, his old seat before he resigned to focus on the governor's campaign, is that a flippable race, or is that something that Democrats see as potentially one they could win?
Democrats are seeing the Soderbergh candidacy as a real positive and giving them hope. They poured a lot of money into that, into her contest. In a way, that race looks very much like a repeat of, you know, a Clinton versus Bush campaign, since each of these candidates has ties, Soderbergh to the Clintons and Waltz to Bush. But it's an open seat, and it is a district that normally leans Republican. Waltz, of course, is stressing the fact that he was a Green Beret and, you know, into counterterrorism, and Soderbergh is really ramping up her ties to the Me Too movement and the climate change and, you know, the progressive side of the Democratic policy. So it's a very, very interesting race that's being watched by a lot of people.
Finally, Dr. Susan McManus, I mean, you mentioned at the top of our conversation that there's kind of an unusual amount of interest or energy around this particular midterm. There were some surprises in the primary. What are you looking for in November, and what do you make of the sort of general atmosphere around this particular midterm election?
Well, the stakes are high. For example, the governor, the next governor of Florida, will have veto power over the congressional redistricting plan. And so that has us have a very strong tie to national politics, but so too does the fact that the fact that the Democrats, if they were to flip these five congressional districts that they think they can, it would have it would go a long way towards helping Democrats take control of the U.S. House. So this race in general, and of course the Senate race, we've already talked about the control there tied to Florida. The bottom line is, this is the most nationalized midterm election in Florida history. Everything has a Trump angle to it, or some kind of national tie. And you even see it in the advertising, the mailers and the TV ads and social media. You know, Democrats are using Trump, and the Republicans are using Trump. And it's just really a very, very nationalized race. And on top of that, millions of dollars are flowing into the state from out of the state. That said, we've seen the other thing that really drives interest is when one party wins the popular vote but loses the Electoral College for the presidency. And of course, that's the situation we have. That usually energizes the party that won the popular vote, Democrats in this case. And we've seen that early on. But I think that the Kavanaugh hearings have now energized the other side, and Republicans are realizing the importance of this to national politics. Lots of new candidates, lots of first-time candidates, 122 women running for the state legislature, uncharted territory, and a lot of younger candidates reflecting the state's changing age demographics. All in all, one of the most exciting midterms I've ever had the opportunity to witness.
Well, Dr. Susan McManus is a USF Distinguished Professor Emerita. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come on Intersection.
Winning trumps everything else. We can have fun. We're having a great time. But when it comes down to it, winning trumps everything.
A 30-year roller coaster for Orlando Magic fans. Is this the year the team's fortunes begin to look up again? Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Orlando Magic is embarking on its 30th season. It's been a rollercoaster ride for fans, and in recent years, the team has had coaches and players come and go. So what can a new coach bring to the Magic? We talked to one fan who's been following the fortunes of the team since its early years in Orlando. Irwin, Dr. Coach Hudson, founder and CEO and lead trainer of Orlando Hoops Incorporated, thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate you having me.
So this is a big year for Orlando Magic as far as the length of time the team has been here in Central Florida in Orlando, the 30th year.
Yep,
so
30th year.
Let me ask you, though, from a fan's perspective, what is it like being an Orlando Magic fan?
Well, it's been a roller coaster. honestly. I mean, it's been fun with the people that we've had come in. And, you know, we've had some great, great players, you know, ranging from the best Shaq, you know, when he was here. Got to hang out with him a lot. So that was a fun time. And then, you know, we had the whole Dwight Howard era, which was major, another big Superman coming to town. And I got actually to train Dwight. I was his trainer one summer. So enjoyed getting to know him after he left Orlando, actually. But it was just, you know, the atmosphere. When I first got here about 27 years ago, it was just seeing how people reacted to having a new franchise in town. It was amazing. You know, I'd been around. I lived in Detroit for a little bit, lived in Atlanta, I lived in D.C. So I'd seen those, you know, franchises and seen what they did to the city. And this being a smaller market, you know, than those guys, it just, you know, it was fanatical. And I remember we actually had the building called the Orlando Fanatic, where it was just a sporting goods store, but it meant so much to see Magic merchandise. You know, I got season tickets, so I'm, you know, I get to see them up close and personal. And it's exciting every game. You know, it's a party almost, party atmosphere. The dancers, everybody, you know, they believe in it. And it's just right now, hopefully we can get us a solid team. You know, we got a new coach coming in. Hopefully everything comes together where we can actually win basketball games. Because, you know, winning trumps everything else. You know, we can have fun. We're having a great time. But when it comes down to it, winning trumps everything.
Speaking of coaches, there have been four head coaches in recent years since the departure of Stan Van Gundy. There's been Jacques Vaughn, James Borrego as an interim, Scott Skiles, Frank Vogel. There's a lot of turnover there. Yes. What do you make of that?
Just instability, I guess, in the more of the head office than just the coaching staff. The coach has been great. I mean, Jacques Vaughn, I knew him personally. His kids worked out in my gym, so I really enjoyed him being in town. Great guy, great coach, knew what he was doing. I just don't know if he had the right personnel at the time when he was here. Then you have Frank Vogel, which is a proven coach. You know, he's a special guy. He's just still, you know, getting the right mix of talent, you know. And, I mean, I don't want to, you know, say anything about Hennigan because I didn't get a chance to know him and meet him. I met him once at one of the
You're talking about the general manager?
The general manager. Mm-hmm. But it was just the fact of who they got in. It made certain trades didn't make sense to us. You know, as fans, you know, you're getting rid of one of the best players who now ended up being the most improved player last year. Just getting rid of Victor Oladipo was one of the probably the low points in recent, you know, recent history.
What was the rationale behind that? How did they explain that?
I don't think there was rationale. Vic was great for us. He was doing great and he was leading us. And he was going to be, you know, the next guy. We were equating him to like a Dwayne Wade type. This kid, and I knew it coming out of college, he was going to be that way. Mm-hmm. And they just didn't understand what they had, I guess. And, you know, I've joked about it in the past that it was almost like we're the JV squad or we're like a G League team where we keep bringing in all these guys and they get so much better and then they go off and they do great things. They're Hall of Fame players when they leave. Ben Wallace, Chauncey Billups, those type guys who are here at the Magic, you know, and go out and win championships other places.
It's got to be frustrating to be the farm team almost for other teams.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it seemed like. I mean, like I said, we had our good times. I mean, Shaq, you know, took us to the finals, and we weren't able to keep that together. And then, you know, Dwight and his group, they took us to the finals also. So we've had some winning. I mean, we're probably the second best winning franchise out of the expansion group, you know, with the Grizzlies, you got the Heat and all those. The Heat's number one, of course. They had they were good before that with Shaq and Dwayne, but then they had the LeBron year, so they're the winningest expansion team. But you know, we're pretty good. We're a formidable team. No one loves to play us because you know we beat you know some of the times when we didn't have really great seasons, we'd beat some of the best teams. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of being consistent.
So this new coach, Steve Clifford, what can you tell us about him? What are you expecting from him?
I mean, I know I've looked him up a little bit. I mean, I don't know as much. I know he was good on defense. He's one of the defensive minded coaches in the league, and he's probably a no nonsense guy. He gets after it.
Is defense where the Magic is lacking? Is that what they need to?
I mean, defense helps wins. I mean, we know that everybody understands that defense is the ultimate thing when you stop other teams. But it's still going to come down to chemistry. It's still going to come down to the players, you know, understanding their true roles and embracing them, you know, and you can work on things on the outside, but when you get in the games, you got to know what you should be doing. You know, that's where you've got a Golden State and you've got these winning teams understand what the roles are. And I don't know if we ever get those guys getting that, or if the coaches have gotten our players to believe in it and buy into it, because they seem to go other places and buy into it. I mean, mm-hmm. Ben Wallace was here doing okay. He did, you know, he was a good player. But when he went to Detroit, he became this, you know, defensive phenomenon. You know, defensive player of the year two or three times in a row. You know, and then now he's a Hall of Fame player out of a small, you know, small school. He wasn't a big name player coming out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we got to get some chemistry. We got to get a coach that really can, you know, get everyone in line. We had that, you know, Chuck Daly during his time tenure was here. He was at that point. Brian Hill was that guy also. So we've had some great coaches come through.
But those are coaches who stuck around for a number of years.
That's the key too. I think it is. And I talk about it all the time. It takes about 5 years, honestly, to make anything grow. There's something called the Chinese bamboo tree that takes 5 years to actually ever break the dirt. And once it does, though, it grows 90 feet in like 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And some people think, hey, did it grow 6 weeks, you know, grow, you know, 90 feet in 6 weeks, or did it grow 90 feet in 5 years? It's 5 years.
So is there a bit of, or has there been a bit of impatience from management not allowing coaches to settle in and kind of just take their lumps and maybe absorb a few losses and then try and sort of build after that?
I think there's a little bit of impatience, but I don't know if it's with them. It's with what we bring in, though, because it seems like those years, even though the coach comes and goes, I mean, it's not really on the coach if we get the right players that stick around here. And with free agency, with the money that's being, you know, shown to these guys, I mean, which I have no problem with them getting as much money as they can.
Mm-hmm.
But when you've got that in your face, why would you, you know, why would you stick around when you can, you know that the chances of winning a championship get slimmer, and then all of a sudden, hey, I can get a chance to make, you know, $100 million for 4 years. You know, they jump ship.
Mm-hmm. It's a no-brainer.
Yeah, there's no loyalty, I mean, in this game, I guess.
We're talking to Irwin Hudson. He's the founder and CEO and lead trainer of Orlando Hoops, talking about the Orlando Magic, their 30th year. So, I mean, speaking of that, just does the Orlando Magic just not have the kind of money it needs to compete at the highest level?
It has to have the money. I mean, we have the location. I do know a lot of things. I mean, as far as some of the players that come through, you know, this is not that high life city like in LA. LA is a big market. They, you know, they stay up all night. Atlanta, those places are more conducive to the young athlete coming in and, you know, not having a family. But when you get a little more settled, I think this is the exact place. And you know, we have Disney, we have Universal, we have SeaWorld. We have so much attraction that brings in money here. You know, mm-hmm. this is a beautiful place. And I know it has to have the finances to be able to afford it. It's just whether or not we're willing to do it.
A lot of winning teams, I guess, are making a trip here when they win,
yes,
right? They
exactly.
go to Disney World.
Exactly. This is the place to come. I mean, but I think it's all about risk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are we willing to take the risk and do that and put money in? And I think we've been burned a couple of times. And, you know, it's not burned on purpose, but we got in players who were going to change the franchise around.
Like Dwight Howard?
Well, not just like Dwight did great. Dwight actually, you know, we went through and we put money in, but he got more money when he left, I believe. But it wasn't on Dwight. It's players like, you know, even Trace McGrady, who was one of the best players in the world, he came in and he got hurt. And injuries, I think, scares the Magic. I mean, we had Gilbert Arenas and his contracts, you know, stuff like that. Those guys were great players and they were, you know, coming in to change the world, but got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we might be a little shell-shocked when it comes to that.
Does the Magic now then, I mean, is there one legacy player that they have that they can build a winning team around?
Right now?
Mm-hmm.
I believe, you know, Aaron Gordon could be that player. I mean, he has all the talent, has all the tools. And, you know, he's special. Every time I see him, he gets better and better. Now we've got Mo Bamba. I mean, it's not going to take one player, though, I believe. I don't, you know, it's not like we don't have a LeBron. We don't have a, you know, a Kobe or a Durant. You know, those guys are one-man shows that can just come and just change things around. You know, and Steph and stuff like that. And, you know, and Steph, those guys are team players, so I don't want to say that they do that. We have a collective three, I think, that could do that. But if just, you know, are we willing to buy into our roles? If everybody's willing to understand who is the lead, you know, who's the Robin, you know, and then who's going to be that extra player that says, okay, I'll do everything else to make us win.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the coaches have got to discern really soon.
So is it like an identity crisis?
I think there might be, or either there's still, we want to find themselves or people want to prove themselves so much. And, you know, when you've got incentives in your contract to, you know, score more threes or do these type of things, you get out of sorts. Instead of being, the big incentive should be winning. Mm-hmm. If they put that as their incentive, that, hey, if we win basketball games, you get paid more, you get your contracts, or you get whatever you get, I think we'd be all right.
It's kind of counterintuitive in some ways, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Walk me back to, you know, when you came to Orlando then. What was the appetite for basketball like? I mean, you talk about the fans back then, pretty passionate people. Is that still there? Is that fire and enthusiasm for basketball still here in Orlando?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's probably more so than ever now because, you know, a lot of the big-time teams are coming in, the big players are coming in, and we're watching that. So we get to see our hometown heroes play against superstars, and it's like, it's almost like Space Jam, where we got, you know, Michael Jordan playing against the Monstars sometimes. But it's fun. We've backed that, and I think right now we're getting more and more involved in it. I mean, the crowds are huge. I mean, there are no, you know, most times they're sellouts. So I believe the enthusiasm is there. It's just people get tired of losing. I mean, and then you'll start waning down, and people get, you know, critical. Mm-hmm. But I believe we win if we can just. And not just be in games, because nobody cares. You know, people forget who came in second. People forget almost. They want to see wins. Mm-hmm. And that's what's going to matter. That's what's going to really bring us up. I mean, the whole Orlando itself is ripe for sports itself. We got the soccer teams in now. Mm-hmm. You know, they're really, you know, boosting. I mean, we when you go to the Magic games, you see the Magic game packed, and all of a sudden you see the whole crowd going toward the arena, for, you know, the soccer arena, and it's like, where'd these people come from? You know, we've got enough people in Orlando, and then there's still more people going to Disney, going everywhere. So mm-hmm. I think so. I mean, I believe we are set.
Is there a bit of an overlap between soccer fans and basketball fans?
I thought so. I mean, I know it was. I mean, at first I thought soccer was going to take a lot of it away. And I don't know. They're packed, and we're packed at the same time. So apparently either we got more people or people are flying in. Mm-hmm. But they come in masses. I've never seen anything like it. And it's because the arenas are right next to each other.
Yeah, the city of Orlando does spend a lot of time kind of promoting that, you know,
yes,
sporting mile, so to speak.
Exactly.
Erwin Hudson, you spend quite a bit of time coaching young players and,
yes,
and mentoring young players. What are you seeing there? Like, is there that kind of passion at the youth level for kids getting into basketball, playing, sort of seeing a future in professional basketball in some regard?
Yeah, definitely. Good, great question, because I've been doing this probably longer than anybody else in Orlando. Training it's taken off. I mean, and it's taken off everywhere across, you know, the United States, especially with the advent of social media. You get to see all the different trainers. But myself and D. Brown, he used to actually play here, coached here with the Magic for a while, slam dunk champ, one of the greatest guys I know, a good friend of mine. He and I kind of started this industry where he had a gym and I built my gym right after him. In fact, when he closed his down, I took most of his equipment. Mm-hmm. And we still stay in touch to this day about talking about trainers. And right now, there's a trainer on every corner. We joke that you could throw a rock outside right now and you'll hit a trainer. You know, somebody who just graduated high school and just, you know, can train. And no knock on them at all. You know, a lot of them just come out and they're passionate about basketball, and they see the Magic. They see the college team, UCF, is taking off. You know, with the, you know, bringing in coaches like Johnny Dawkins helped out, you know, and all the other coaches. Spiro, I was good friends with Coach Spiro for a long time. And all, you know, everything about it has turned basketball into this, you know, thing now. Because Florida itself was predominantly a football state for the longest, with
sure,
Miami, Florida State, and Florida. You know, and now UCF. Come on, that's, you know, it's football dominant. But basketball took off about probably, I'd say, 15 years ago when – 10, 15 years, you know, in that area, because we had kids like coming up, Joel Berry, Nick Calathes. You know, these are McDonald All-Americans, Mr. Basketball in the state of Florida. Mm-hmm. Chandler Parsons, one of the biggest players ever. I coached him in high school and trained him. Still, he's still one of my best clients ever. Joey Rodriguez, these guys. We had guys like that. Austin Rivers are coming homegrown, and they were skilled players. They weren't, you know, rough and tough brutes. In fact, I met with John Lucas a couple of years ago. He's one of the big guys. He was number one draft pick in basketball back in the day from Maryland, and a U.S. tennis star and everything. And he's one of the godfathers of training. And he's out in Houston, and we had this big debate on whether Houston or Florida was better at basketball. Mm-hmm. And we come to the conclusion that Florida was a lot more skilled. Houston was a lot more tougher. Houston, mm-hmm, they'll go through a wall. They'll do everything, but or the state of Texas. And But he realized that, hey, the players we're producing and the stuff we're doing, you know, with the Junior Magic and all these different leagues, FBVA and YBOA, you know, all the leagues that we have going now, we're pushing basketball as a skilled sport. And people are believing that they can do it starting at age six. I mean, I train kids from 6 years old to the NBA. I mean, and all in one day. I'll have one kid come in, and they'll progressively go to middle school, to my high school groups, and then all of a sudden I have a guy trying to work out for the Magic the next day working out with me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it's a fun time for basketball.
Just back to the Magic. Sure. Finally, Irwin Hudson, what are you looking forward to most about this season?
Oh, man. I mean, it's tough because I don't know. I'm excited. You know, I just got my package, you know, and showing, hey, what games I got this year and everything. And I look so forward to seeing the games. But with me, it's just the atmosphere for the Magic right now, playing, because we're rebuilding. Everybody, you know, understands that. It would be awesome if we do some great stuff. It would be awesome if we win, but I'm not expecting wins. My expectations have been managed for this year. I've seen a lot. I've seen the ups and downs, and I think this is our down time, and we don't have that stick right now that's going to say, hey, we should be winning. And that's a good thing, and that's probably when we do our best, is when we're not expected to do so well. But I'm looking forward to seeing the atmosphere, the fans, the walking around the arena, and just, you know, everybody there. There's, you know, from young to old, kids who just are seeming like, hey, we have hope because we have teams coming in. And then when we do beat that big team, I mean, when we beat Golden State this year, if we beat, you know, Los Angeles Lakers, those are going to be just huge triumphs for Orlando, saying, okay, we can do this again.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully the young guys that we have coming in, you know, see that and don't get discouraged and don't jump ship early or don't have their agents thinking, hey, you know, get me traded out of here. Because I'm telling you, this is the place if you really, you know, look at it. Because I've lived around these cities. I've traveled around the United States. Orlando is probably one of the best places on the earth. And I've been born and raised in Mississippi, you know, up until I was 21 and graduated from Mississippi State. I've never seen a city like this. And, you know, I didn't want to go anywhere else after I moved here mm-hmm. in 93.
What about the Knicks?
Oh, my gosh, the Knicks, man. They just I got so many friends that are diehard Knicks fans. Big shout-out to Joey Rodriguez. I mean, he's one of my players back in the day, and he was a super Knicks fan. He'd go crazy about him. Diehard, whether they're winning or losing. But I just don't know what happened to that franchise. They have not found a way to make, you know, it work. And, you know, they're the same way with us with the coaching staff. But they have the money. They have the market. They've been giving players lots of money. And it's, for some reason, can't seem to get it to, you know, to click. So I'm worried about them.
Well, Irwin, Dr. Coach Hudson, founder and CEO and lead trainer of Orlando Hoops Incorporated, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, I appreciate it, man. This has been awesome.
Still to come.
Eatonville has been able to survive because of its internal strengths, but it's also not been challenged by the overt racial antagonism that has been perpetrated in other places in this country historically.
The enduring strength of Eatonville, one of the country's oldest black towns. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Eatonville is one of the oldest black towns in the United States. So why did Eatonville survive when other black towns have not? Joining us for more is NY Natheri with the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community. Thank you so much for coming in.
Pleasure to be on your air.
We're also joined by Everett Fly. He's a landscape architect, recipient of a National Endowment for the Humanities Medal for his work to preserve the integrity of African-American places and landmarks. Everett, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Everett, I want to start with you. How unique is Eatonville, and how many places like it were there once?
Well, Eatonville is absolutely unique. There were never an enormous number of black towns. Most of them were settlements. They were never incorporated as a municipal body. So there were probably more than 2,000 settlements across the United States from the time of the establishment of the colonies to today. And so the communities that were actually incorporated as governmental bodies, there were probably more than a couple of hundred. And so to have Eatonville still alive and functioning is extremely unique.
How did Eatonville first come across your radar? Because you were instrumental in making sure that a road was not built through this town. So how did that happen?
Well, I had actually researched through archives and newspaper accounts the existence and the evolution of Eatonville. And I had a classmate when I was in the Graduate School of Design at Harvard who happened to be from Orlando. And he became aware of the challenge or the threat of the road to Eatonville. And if I remember correctly, he suggested that Mrs. Nethery contact me and see if I could be of some help.
Had you sort of helped out other towns or other municipalities or other places that were facing destruction, kind of make sure they got that historic status and survived before Eatonville? Was this the first one?
No. By the time that I got to work in Eatonville, I had done similar work for the National Park Service and the National Trust for Historic Preservation in communities like or states like Kansas, California, Maryland, and Michigan.
Why is it important to preserve places like Eatonville? Why do you think it's important to make sure that they don't just vanish or get swallowed up by other municipalities?
Well, places like Eatonville are actually contributors to the overall civic and educational and cultural life of America. In other words, they don't only help black people. They help white people. They help Native American and indigenous people. They help people of all persuasions, demographic, economic sectors. So we have a bad habit in America of just saying, well, the black towns help themselves and no one else. But they were actually parts of networks, economic networks, educational networks, you know, even environmental networks that helped and benefited us all. So every time we lose one, we lose a part of the overall legacy and content of America, civic life, cultural life, and heritage.
In my theory, let me bring you in on the conversation. Aside from the work of Mr. Fly and making sure that that road didn't get built through Eatonville, that the town survived, what else would you put it down to, the fact that Eatonville has persisted and it now has this identity as, you know, the place of Zora Neale Hurston? You have the festival every year. What is it that keeps the town going?
I would say that there are four foundational pieces or aspects of Eatonville life that account for its ability, at least internally, to persist. And those pieces are faith in God, a family, education, the commitment to doing the best you could educationally, and civic pride. From an internal perspective, I think that those really are the blocks upon which the town stands.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested to hear the question that you ask about how is it that actually Eatonville has survived from an external perspective, because, of course, we know what happened historically in Rosewood.
Mm-hmm.
We know what has happened in the what was called the Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We may not have time on this air, but it would be very interesting to hear Everett Fly weigh in on the external threat. And, of course, we know what happened in Ocoee.
Right.
Literally today, maybe half an hour's drive west of Eatonville. So Eatonville has been able to survive because of its internal strengths, but it's also not been challenged by the overt racial antagonism that has been perpetrated in other places in this country historically.
And when you talk about Ocoee and Rosewood, I mean, the destruction of those places, those were external issues, right?
Exactly.
That wasn't just sort of economic decline.
No, the whites came and killed and pushed out the people who were there. So there's not any finesse to this. They were actually obliterated because of physical force.
What about the sense of what keeps Eatonville going now, though? I mean, there must be some challenges economically You mentioned education as one of the bedrocks of what keeps Eatonville going, but are there some challenges there, access to education?
Oh, absolutely. I think that if you look at the two initiatives that our organization has made a generational commitment to internally, it is about education. We talk about the 21st century workforce and the good-paying jobs. Those are all connected basically to science, technology, engineering, and math. Well, happily, Eatonville has a legacy of that kind of educational structure with the historic Robert Hungerford Industrial and Normal School. So for us as a preservation organization, we're looking to build upon that as a basis for seeing the community galvanize around that educational excellence, which is so much a part of the history. So without a doubt, the focus on educational excellence, and not just in first grade or the elementary schools, we're looking at what we call very early childhood intervention and having families appreciate the importance of toddlers, 2 and 3 years old, really being exposed to the kinds of inputs that will allow them to succeed.
Education is one thing. What about the kinds of things that are going to keep folks in Eatonville? Are there opportunities for people in Eatonville, or do they have to look outside the boundaries of the town?
But historically, and this is a nice point, Eatonville historically has always been known as a bedroom community.
Mm-hmm.
We are not the kind of historic black town that Boley, Oklahoma was, for example, or even Mound Bayou, Mississippi, where there were banking institutions and certain institutional infrastructure that allowed people to work in Eatonville. We have always, as a community, worked outside and slept, recreated, governed within the context of the community. So the fact that our challenge is just to make certain that the young people coming up have the ability to work around the Central Florida area in the good-paying jobs, and then they can come back to Eatonville as a bedroom community, because historically that's what it was.
Mm-hmm. Everett Fly, back to the question about kind of external forces, or what it looks like from somebody outside of Eatonville looking in, aside from jumping in and just sort of telling the county, look, there's a historic reason why you shouldn't build a road through this town, what else, from your point of view, keeps a place like Eatonville going?
Well, obviously there... The fact that the town governs itself, in other words, the civil right to be able to govern yourself allows the town to be able to stand up, say, we don't want the road, and have a legal voice, have precedence to do that, and make its own decision. Mm-hmm. So that, to me, in all these towns that have the category of municipal incorporated communities, they all have that ability. The places that were just settlements, many of them have been, as NY pointed out, have been wiped out because they didn't have that tool, governance tool, to be able to stand up and make a case in either direction. And then by the same point, if Eatonville wanted to, you know, on its own develop some strategies or develop some programs or some initiatives to do things internally, they, as a government, they have the ability to do that.
Mm-hmm. What about places like Goldsboro, which was annexed by Sanford many, many years ago, but they still have a sense of identity? They have some economic challenges, perhaps, but how does a place like Goldsboro kind of preserve what they have still?
Well, again, they're citizens of that community and citizens of the United States. So they have the right and the opportunity to stand up and take what they would like to have or not. But in any case, they still contribute, just like I said at the beginning, they still contribute to the overall network of neighborhoods, as NY just pointed out, civic activities and civic role in a community.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly, you know, any community like Goldsboro should protect its heritage. They should do as much research and documentation as they can and do as much as they can in terms of education, educating the residents of the neighborhood about the importance of their history as well as the larger community that might control them. It's so important for these communities to stand up and expose their own history and protect it.
I'm wondering, too, after your work with Eatonville, did you get a flood of inquiries from other towns, other places, wanting to see what they could do to preserve what they had? And I'm wondering if things have changed in the last two decades as to the approach to or the attitude towards preserving places of significance to African-American communities or Latino communities or other communities in the United States.
Well, no, I didn't. I did not get a flood of inquiries after Eatonville. It's been more like a steady growth of inquiries. One of the reasons is I think there's a growing awareness of the significance of cultural history and cultural resources in community planning, city planning, and that kind of thing. But then, on the other hand, there are programs such as within the National Park Service. Since the time I started working with Eatonville, there are initiatives like the Historic Cultural Settlements and Historic Cultural Landscape Initiative, and those particularly allow protection of communities, well, like Goldsboro or Eatonville. And when I started out with the work, those programs were not in place. So it's very difficult to make the case and put a place like Goldsboro on the National Register, for example, which would lend it some protection. But now we have National Park Service has those kinds of initiatives, and then they pass those down to the various states to implement them as well. So that's made it easier, but it's been more kind of a steady growth.
If I could, I'd like to add that over the, I would say, last decade, we are seeing within these communities, neighborhoods, and settlements, we see ourselves as a colleague, a lot of interest. For example, in 2014, the formation of the Historic Black Towns and Settlements Alliance really reflects a bit of what your question asks. Mm-hmm. And that is a four-state collaborative of towns, Tuskegee, Alabama, Hobson City, Alabama, Mound Bayou, Mississippi, and Grambling, Louisiana, in addition to Eatonville. Now, there's an in-common connection with Booker T. Washington, the founder of Tuskegee Institute. But I would say to you that we have seen, for example, a year-round inquiry on a regular basis to us as a historic preservation organization. And in that instance, I would echo what Everett Fly has said about a kind of interest within these communities and neighborhoods to try to stand up and make certain that the history and culture that they represent is captured and appreciated both by their children, but also from the larger external community as well.
NYU Theory is with the Association to Preserve Eatonville Community. Thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate the opportunity.
We're also joined by Everett Fly. He's a landscape architect, recipient of the National Endowment for Humanities Medal for his work to preserve the integrity of African-American places and landmarks. Everett, thank you so much as well.
Thank you for having me.
And that interview first aired on Intersection in July 2017. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. Download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter @Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.